Chapter 19. Shut up. Put your light out and turn in, you confound its willing pig you. Do you hear me, you beast? The kicking stopped, and in the pause the muzzy oracular voice announced from within, Ah, Massey, now that's another thing. Massey's deep. Who's that aft there? You, Stern. He'll drink himself into a fit of horrors. The chief engineer appeared vague and big at the corner of the engine room. He will be good enough for duty tomorrow. I would let him be, Mr. Massey. Stern slipped away into his berth, and at once had to sit down. His head swam with exultation. He got into his bunk, as if in a dream. A feeling of profound peace, of pacific joy, came over him. On deck all was quiet. Mr. Massey, with his ear against the door of Jack's cabin, listened critically to a deep, stertorous breathing within. This was a dead drunk sleep. The bout was over. Tranquilized on that score, he too went in, and with slow wriggles, got out of his old tweed jacket. It was a garment with many pockets, which he used to put on at odd times of the day, being subject to sudden chilly fits, and when he felt warmed he would take it off, and hang it about anywhere all over the ship. It would be seen swinging on belaying pins, thrown over the heads of winches, suspended on people's very door handles for that matter. Was he not the owner? But his favorite place was a hook on a wooden awning stanchion on the bridge, almost against the binnacle. He had even in the early days more than one tussle on that point with Captain Wally, who desired the bridge to be kept tidy. He had been overawed then. Of late, though, he had been able to defy his partner with impunity. Captain Wally never seemed to notice anything now. As to the Malays, in their awe of that scowling man, not one of the crew would dream of laying a hand on the thing, no matter where or what it swung from. With an unexpectedness which made Mr. Massey jump and drop the coat at his feet, there came from the next berth the crash and thud of a headlong, jingling, clattering fall. The faithful Jack must have dropped to sleep suddenly as he sat at his revels, and now had gone over chair and all, breaking, as it seemed by the sound, every single glass and bottle in the place. After the terrific smash all was still for a time in there, as though he had killed himself outright on the spot. Mr. Massey held his breath. At last a sleepy uneasy groaning sigh was exhaled slowly on the other side of the bulkhead. I hope to goodness he's too drunk to wake up now, muttered Mr. Massey. The sound of a softly knowing laugh nearly drove him to despair. He swore violently under his breath. The fool would keep him awake all night now for certain. He cursed his luck. He wanted to forget his maddening troubles in sleep sometimes. He could detect no movements. Without apparently making the slightest attempt to get up, Jack went on sniggering to himself where he lay, then began to speak, where he had left off as it were, Massey. I love the dirty rascal. He would like to see his poor old Jack starve, but just you look where he has climbed to. Dot 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 he hiccoed in a superior, leisurely manner. Dot 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 hip owning it with the best. A lottery ticket you want. Ha! Ha! I will give you lottery tickets, my boy. Let the old ship sink and the old chum starve, that's right. He don't go wrong, Massey don't. Not he. He's a genius, that man is. That's the way to win your money. Ship and chum must go. The silly fool has taken it to heart, muttered Massey to himself. And, listening with a softened expression of face for any slight sign of returning drowsiness, he was discouraged profoundly by a burst of laughter full of joyful irony. Would like to see her at the bottom of the sea. Oh, you clever, clever devil. Wish her sunk, eh? I should think you would, my boy. The damned old thing and all your troubles with her. Rake in the insurance money, turn your back on your old chum, all's well, gentleman again. A grim stillness had come over Massey's face. Only his big black eyes rolled uneasily. The raving fool. And yet it was all true. Yes. Lottery tickets too. All true. What? Beginning again? He wished he wouldn't. Dot dot dot, but it was even so. The imaginative drunkard on the other side of the bulkhead shook off the death-like stillness that after his last words had fallen on the dark ship moored to a silent shore. Don't you dare to say anything against George Massey, Esquire. When he's tired of waiting, he will do away with her. Look out. Down she goes, chum and all. He'll know how to. Dot, the voice hesitated, weary, dreamy, lost, as if dying away in a vast open space. Dot, find a trick that will work. He's up to it, never fear. Dot, he must have been very drunk, for at last the heavy sleep gripped him with the suddenness of a magic spell, and the last word lengthened itself into an interminable, noisy, indrawn snore. And then even the snoring stopped, and all was still. But it seemed as though Mr. Massey had suddenly come to doubt the efficacy of sleep, as against a man's troubles. Or perhaps he had found the relief he needed in the stillness of a calm contemplation that may contain the vivid thoughts of wealth, of a stroke of luck, of long idleness, and may bring before you the imagined form of every desire. For, turning about and throwing his arms over the edge of his bunk, he stood there with his feet on his favorite old coat, looking out through the round port into the night over the river. Sometimes a breath of wind would enter and touch his face, a cool breath charged with the damp, fresh feel from a vast body of water. A glimmer here and there was all he could see of it, and once he might after all suppose he had dozed off, since there appeared before his vision, unexpectedly and connected with no dream, a row of flaming and gigantic figures 30712 making up a number such as you may see on the lottery ticket. And then all at once the port was no longer black. It was pearly gray, framing a shore crowded with houses, thatched roof beyond thatched roof, walls of mats and bamboo, gables of carved teak timber. Rows of dwellings raised on a forest of piles lined the steely band of the river, brimful and still, with the tide at the turn. This was Batu Beru and the day had come. Mr. Massey shook himself, put on the tweed coat, and, shivering nervously as if from some great shock, made a note of the number. A fortunate rare hint that. Yes, but to pursue fortune one wanted money ready cash. Then he went out and prepared to descend into the engine room. Several small jobs had to be seen to, and Jack was lying dead drunk on the floor of his cabin, with the door locked at that. His gorge rose at the thought of work. Eh? But if he wanted to do nothing, you had to get first a good bit of money. A ship won't save you. He cursed the Cephala. True, all true. He was tired of waiting for some chance that would rid him at last of that ship that had turned out a curse on his life. Ziv, the deep, interminable hoot of the steam whistle had, in its grave, vibrating note, something intolerable, which sent a slight shudder down Mr. Van Wyck's back. It was the early afternoon. The Cephala was leaving Batu Beru for Pangu, the next place of call. She swung in the stream, scantily attended by a few canoes, and, glitting on the broad river, became lost to view from the Van Wyck bungalow. Its owner had not gone this time to see her off. Generally he came down to the wharf, exchanged a few words with the bridge while she cast off, and waved his hand to Captain Wally at the last moment. This day he did not even go as far as the balustrade of the veranda. He couldn't see me if I did, he said to himself. Wonder whether he can make out the house at all. And this thought somehow made him feel more alone than he had ever felt for all these years. What was it, 6 or 7? 7. A long time. He sat on the veranda with a closed book on his knee, and, as it were, looked out upon his solitude, as if the fact of Captain Wally's blindness had opened his eyes to his own. There were many sorts of heartaches and troubles, and there was no place where they could not find a man out. And he felt ashamed, as though he had for 6 years behaved like a peevish boy. His thought followed the Cephala on her way. On the spur of the moment he had acted impulsively, turning to the thing most pressing. And what else could he have done? Later on he should see. It seemed necessary that he should come out into the world, for a time at least. He had money, something could be arranged. He would grudge no time, no trouble, no loss of his solitude. It weighed on him now, and Captain Wellie appeared to him as he had sat shading his eyes, as if, being deceived in the trust of his faith, he were beyond all the good and evil that can be wrought by the hands of men. Mr. Van Wyck's thoughts followed the Cephala down the river, winding about through the belt of the coast forest, between the buttressed shafts of the big trees, through the mangrove strip, and over the bar. The ship crossed it easily in broad daylight, piloted, as it happened, by Mr. Stern, who took the watch from 4 to 6, and then went below to hug himself with delight at the prospect of being virtually employed by a rich man like Mr. Van Wyck. He could not see how any hitch could occur now. He did not seem able to get over the feeling of being fixed up at last. From 6 to 8, in the course of duty, the Serang looked alone after the ship. As he had a clear road before her now till about 3 in the morning, when she would close with the Pangu group. At 8 Mr. Stern came out cheerily, to take charge again till midnight. At 10 he was still chirruping and humming to himself on the bridge, and about that time Mr. Van Wyck's thought abandoned the Cephala. Mr. Van Wyck had fallen asleep at last. Massey, blocking the engine room companion, jerked himself into his tweed jacket surlily, while the second waited with a scowl. Oh, you came out? You sot. Well, what have you got to say for yourself? He had been in charge of the engines till then. A somber fury darkened his mind. A hot anger against the ship, against the facts of life, against the men for their cheating, against himself too, because of an inward tremor of his heart. An incomprehensible growl answered him. What? Can't you open your mouth now? You yelp out your infernal rot loud enough when you are drunk. What do you mean by abusing people in that way? You old useless boozer, you. Can't help it. Don't remember anything about it. You shouldn't listen. You dare to tell me? What do you mean by going on a drunk like this? Don't ask me. Sick of the damn boilers you would be. Sick of life. I wish you were dead, then. You've made me sick of you. Don't you remember the uproar you made last night? You miserable old soaker. No, I don't. Don't want to. Drink is drink. I wonder what prevents me from kicking you out. What do you want here? Relieve you. You've been long enough down there, George. Don't you George me, you tippling old rascal, you. If I were to die tomorrow you would starve. Remember that. Say Mr. Massey. Mr. Massey, repeated the other stolidly. Disheveled, with dull bloodshot eyes, a snuffy, grimy shirt, greasy trousers, naked feet thrust into ragged slippers, he bolted in head down directly Massey had made way for him. The chief engineer looked around. The deck was empty as far as the taffrail. All the native passengers had left in Batu Beru this time, and no others had joined. The dial of the patent log tinkled periodically in the dark at the end of the ship. It was a dead calm, and, under the clouded sky, through the still air that seemed to cling warm, with a seaweed smell, to her slim hull, on a sea of somber gray and unwrinkled, the ship moved on an even keel, as if floating detached in empty space. But Mr. Massey slapped his forehead, tottered a little, caught hold of a bellying pin at the foot of the mast. I shall go mad, he muttered, walking across the deck. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.